Welcome to The Created Life. Each week, The Created Life podcast offers insightful, inspiring interviews with entrepreneurs, creatives, and people just like you about being empowered, living with vitality, and creating positive change in the world through creative action. The Created Life covers a wide range of topics relating to personal growth, adventure, inspiration, business, social impact, fitness, and health. My name is Damian Taggart. I'm a serial social impact entrepreneur, and I'll be your host on this journey. Thanks for joining me for this episode of The Created Life. Welcome back to another great episode of The Created Life. It's tax day here in the United States, so hopefully you've got that sometimes unpleasant civic duty out of the way and are ready to enjoy this week's episode. Today I speak with a really engaging and inspiring man who spent 22 years in service in the United States Navy before founding a cybersecurity company with one of his best friends. Michael Davis offers a positive perspective on life that I find really refreshing. He's chair of the Human Rights Alliance and, as I mentioned, CEO of a new company. I think he has a lot of great insights, and I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, Michael, thanks for joining me this week.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you for having me. This is awesome. Actually, I'm pretty proud of this.
Cool. Yeah, it's great to have a 22-year veteran. So thank you for your service.
Yeah, it's like a weekend. You think about when you first joined, or at least think about joining the military, you think, oh, I'm just going to do a couple of years, and then all of a sudden 2 years become six, and six becomes 10, and you start having fun. Mm. And you never start having fun. In my case, that's what happened. It kind of started out with this just duty to service, and duty to service became a kind of career choice. Right. It was fun. Yeah, I had a blast. Yeah.
So you were in the Navy, and you served as a information security officer?
Or? Yeah, it was a little bit of everything, because you kind of come in as one thing and you leave as another thing. And in my case, it was all within the IT spectrum. So I came in, was called a radio man. Sexy. And then radio man eventually became kind of an information systems technician type of manager role, which is what it is today, as a matter of fact. So yeah, you kind of, and it was really streamlined towards just kind of communications, really. And as the world changed, communications changed, and it became what it is today. So it's, it's pretty robust.
So when you started in the Navy, it was more general communications, and then it sort of transitioned as the internet kind of came to be.
Yeah, exactly. As technology became more innovative, mm-hmm. beyond just satellite communications, mm-hmm. The internet changed the kind of dynamic of all the things that we do. So the job itself today is it actually is kind of two lanes.
Right.
One still is primarily communications, and the other is really focused on IT.
So, mm-hmm. yeah. So if you were in the Navy for 22 years, yeah. you must have started when you were like 8 years old or something like that? Or like...
Now you're just being funny. Yeah. 18? Yeah, 18. I don't think I told mm-hmm. you, I didn't join the Navy. Like, I wasn't like, as a kid, wanting to join the Navy. It
right.
just became a fluke. In fact, I went to a music kind of high school, fine arts high school, and I wanted to write music and compose music and write for film scores and things like that.
Hmm.
And I don't know, I woke up one day and just kind of decided, I want something different.
Wow.
And it just became a thing. And my recruiter was probably the best guy, who was like, hey, you know, if you come in as a musician, you're going to be you're going to have fun, but you won't like it.
Right.
Which is the obvious choice at the time. And long story short, he says, what are you good at? Other things you're good at. And I thought, I don't like to talk. And that's when it all kind of streamlined into communication. So, yeah.
That's interesting. So it was kind of, it was a fluke, you
said? Totally a fluke. Huh. And I never stopped my love for music. In fact, everywhere I was stationed, there was always a piano somewhere.
Hmm.
So I kind of streamlined from like really focusing on a music career and just found music everywhere I was stationed and made it happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember I'm on a carrier, 5,000 of my best friends. I taught a music theory class. I bought some recorders, and we just did it. Like an hour-long session for a week or so. I mean, once a week, and just kind of worked that magic. And it just kind of kept it going. So I always had music. I always had that energy. And that's really the key to this whole story, is that you know, you don't have to give up one dream to kind of acquire another one.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually have both. And that's what I had. I had this amazing kind of structured career path, which I was probably needed.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had this layer of Mike Davis that was still there, that was still loving music and still loved to write music and still embraced the arts and creativity and
totally.
Yeah, so it was a balance.
That's cool. And so how long ago did you leave the military?
I retired 2016, so 3 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so it's been 3 years of freedom.
Nice. And then just recently you started your new company, Merrick.
I did, yeah. I worked at the laboratory, as you know, in Los Alamos for a couple of years and kind of information security realm. And I woke up one day, I thought of the same thing, kind of a fluky, kind of, you know, impactful idea of going beyond my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I still have my business partner who was my previous protege, and he was teaching me things now, which mm-hmm. is really the point where you start to kind of realize, okay, we're growing to the next level. Like, if you're teaching me things now, and I was your mentor for years, Luke is a great guy. And so we decided to go pick up a company of ourselves, of our own. And Santa Fe was a good opportunity to do it. It's really, I wouldn't say it's a tech-centric city, mm-hmm. but we can make it that way. And that's what we're doing with Merrick.
Totally. I think that's great. Yeah, there's a few other startups in Santa Fe that are kind of like moving... you know, moving the city in that direction a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's great. So you've only been, or when did you guys found Merrick Security?
We started Merrick in October of last year. So we're not even 6 months old. I think what is it, imagine? Yeah, we're just a little baby. We're kind of a toddler. But the interesting part about that is that we've networked ourselves so well enough to kind of be able to functionally move in a direction where we don't feel so uncomfortable in this space,
mm-hmm.
Meaning that we've worked with the city on business development plans, and we've worked with the city on getting involved with some of the city initiatives and things like that. And it's been pretty open-minded in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
The business development kind of center, even the incubator that we have here in Santa Fe, has really developed a lot of our trust in ourselves to continue this path.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we didn't have that, and we started out kind of like, just what do we do next? it would be a different story to tell you right now, but we've been very fortunate. We landed an IBM Watson contract, which is, as you probably know, it's the AI kind of formatted, and it's been great. It's been a nice network, and it's great to have that as your first kind of leap into the entrepreneurship world,
mm-hmm.
Which is another lesson that we learned, is that everything matters. Everything touches you, and it's okay to let things impact you in some way. Because we didn't come into Merrick Security Solutions to land an IBM job. We landed an IBM job because we were open-minded.
Mm.
And it just happened to be a passive, you know, who do you know? And then there's a LinkedIn account. And then there's an email that comes to me. You know, so all these things kind of transpired because we were open-minded to the idea of opportunity. But we started out with this idea of just working strictly kind of in the federal space of contracts. Which is kind of our background, which makes sense.
Right.
But we ended up opening ourselves up to that.
Private sector.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we also opened ourselves up to the political kind of capital that comes along with businesses, getting involved with the city and state.
Social capital that you're building through relationships.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. And it is more or less a, you know, a lot of handshaking, a lot of lunches, a lot of dinners,
mm-hmm.
but they build equity. And
mm-hmm.
then the equity index, much more than just the financial aspect to it. So,
totally. And it seems like, from my experience, to be effective in that way, it's, yes, you're networking, and yes, maybe you're doing it for a business purpose.
Right.
But you're doing it, you're actually going at it from the perspective of making meaningful connections with people.
Absolutely, 100%. Because we can't survive by ourselves.
Totally.
And we wouldn't have started a business if we thought that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the smartest guys in the room. We're never going to be the smartest guys in the room. We hope to collaborate with the smartest guys in the room.
Yeah, right.
We hope to collaborate with other people who are thinking like us in terms of like community development.
Right.
But we don't want to walk into a space and say, oh yeah, we're the security people, and you know, we want to really network with people who don't think like us, to be honest, and people who are not in that realm of ITism, and get out of that kind of structure and literally like build a network and build a community that way. So
yeah, so it sounds like you guys, so it's a new company, but it sounds like you're on a fast track to some big things.
It really is, and that's something that we did not anticipate for. I think that's another lesson is that scalability is key. Once you start to kind of navigate this space of really kind of legislating your own path,
mm-hmm.
We have to prepare ourselves for the scalable. Like, how do we prepare? How do we do this job and prepare for the mass people who may want our services? You may, be careful what you ask for, right? You start a company and all of a sudden you got 10 people who want your services, and you can only fulfill 4 because you haven't scaled well enough. Mm-hmm. That's not good either. So we've been able to kind of structure because of that pace that we didn't anticipate for, especially with the IBM aspect of it. We have to slow it down and kind of recalibrate. And,
mm-hmm.
and we've done some great, partnerships with companies out of Albuquerque that are much more robust than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And we've looked into partnerships with other people here locally. So we're preparing ourselves for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely, you lose sleep over that.
Yeah.
Knowing that you're in a, you have one vision of a rhythm, but you're met with an incredible difference. A really faster pace of that rhythm, and you gotta really learn how to handle that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, has there any been any real major surprises to you or major challenges that you weren't expecting?
There's always that. Actually, mm-hmm. I think you can always answer that question. I think the biggest challenge for us is just structuring our relationship as business partners, because mm-hmm. we left a mentor-protege relationship, and we've been friends for 10 years through that. Luke was also in the Navy as well. And now we're functionally getting married. I mean, it's crazy. But we have to have these long discussions about finances and not just our business credit, but our personal credit. And
right.
We have to talk about, we have to have meetings and talk about our intention. Because
mm-hmm.
every business has, in some ways, that a business is a highway. You got to figure out what's your exit compared to my exit. Maybe Luke wants to have this business grow to 20, 30 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I may just, as a CEO, just grow this business for a year and bail
mm-hmm.
and sell it to somebody else. So we have to have those kind of discussions, which has been different for us relative to just kind of like our normal brotherhood. Now we're business partners and we have to be accountable. Like even right now, we're in tax season. So we're having to navigate our tax return together, which isn't that bad. It's just a matter of let's peek into the covers of what's going on in your life, my life, and we didn't anticipate that being so intimate.
Totally, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what kind of business structure do you guys have?
So we're LLC.
Okay.
Partnership runs. So.
And is it equal partnership?
Well, we did not do it that way for again. We kind of started out in the federal space, and within the federal space, there are all these initiatives and programs for minority-owned businesses
mm-hmm.
that perhaps don't expand to other business, other
sure.
Races. So we put my position at 51%
mm-hmm.
and Luke was at 49% for that purpose.
Oh yeah,
but we pretty much do the same thing. We kind of leverage it in that way. So it's pretty mm-hmm. common in our space to do it that way. So
cool. And have you guys created any kind of advisory board or board of advisors?
Yes, we have. It's funny you mention that because. Again, you never get anywhere by yourself. So what I did and what we did together, we reached out to all of our either mentors, my own mentors, business people that I've met along the way, and they've become our advisors. Also,
mm-hmm.
Friends we met here that really have impacted us. We have a friend who's a psychotherapist, and she's part of our advisory board, and she's kind of leans in and a kind of psychosis of and almost neurosis of owning a business.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we've definitely reached back to my mentors, and they've obliged, and they actually hold us accountable.
Totally.
We actually make them quarterly, we kind of produce kind of a report that says how we're doing, and it kind of holds us accountable and holds them accountable, and it puts us in a kind of really a more streamlined position to move forward. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think having someone else to especially if you're a CEO of a company,
right.
Having somebody else who's who you have to answer to.
Absolutely.
And who's hopefully, like you said, smarter than you are, has more experience than you do, to kind of look at what you're doing and reflect things back at you is super, super helpful.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we're very fortunate to have people who really hold us to the fire. Yeah, I think anyone who wants to start a business on their own and they call themselves a CEO for the sake of not having a boss, that is the wrong mindset.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You're always going to have a boss, whether it be your friends or your lovers or your people who came before you or a really aggressive venture.
Totally. I think that's another misconception people have about doing their own business it's like, oh, I'm going to be my own boss and I'm going to have this easy life.
Yeah.
But it's like, actually, you're going to be working all the time.
Exactly. There are moments that I get up at 2 o'clock in the morning because I forgot to write a report or I think of a great line for a proposal that we're looking at a job, and I'll just get up and do it, and I realize that's never happened to me before ever in my entire career, and I've woken up in the middle of the night and got to and worked on a document and just put back to sleep. But yeah, you're never off the clock.
Totally. So I just wanted to say, like, was there anything that what did being in the Navy like teach you?
Oh my goodness.
Like, what are some of the big takeaways of that experience?
There's so many ways to answer that question, but I think the biggest takeaway for me was I was a chief. I retired as a chief in the Navy, and I would always have meetings in the morning. There was what we call quarters, it doesn't matter, but I would have to put out like what's happening, all the do's and the don'ts, and this is that happening. But every day I could look back in my division and see the youngest person in the back there, whether he's been in the Navy 10 minutes or 10 hours, it doesn't matter, and know that he's going to replace me one day. So the biggest lesson I learned from that is that you're always training your replacement. Because you're never just that important to be the only guy who can do one thing or two things. Everyone does everything. But it's up to you to kind of recognize that as a leader, that you're going to eventually have to retire, you're going to eventually have to leave, you have to go somewhere else and do something else. And somebody has to be able to replace you. If you didn't train the person well enough, then what are you doing?
Totally.
You're absolutely in this kind of state of like, yep, you're it. And you realize that, you know, you have to negate, you have to really nurture that process. So it's like, I'm not a parent, but I can see the element of like, same thing, you're raising your kid to kind of grow into a man or a woman that is respectful and has peace in their life and happiness, because you've given them that choice to choose that, or that world to choose that. And that's kind of what we do in the Navy, especially when you have people or young folks who never had a father, or parents have been just kind of dysfunctional. And now you're that image. You're the new father figure or the new mother figure. So long story short, yeah, that was probably the biggest takeaway from it, is that I always felt at ease knowing that that my replacement is just right there.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward 10 years, he'll be standing in my uniform and in front of his own division or her own division doing the same thing I'm doing. So you never felt alone.
Right. That's cool. Yeah. And are you thinking, I mean, how is that lesson translated over to you in business as well?
Good question, because as you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's pretty, you know, you can really kind of nurture it on the opposite spectrum, that where people do hoard more information here on this side of the table, whereas in the Navy, you're just giving it out all the time because you want people to be smarter. I think I've tried to partner with other organizations. I think they've seen that. In fact, for example, I recently had a company come from Albuquerque to visit me, my office here in Santa Fe, and it was a cold call, like me just hitting them up and say, hey, you guys do similar things. Can we talk about that? You know? And the first thing he said to me when he came to my office, he said, thank you for reaching your out, because normally everyone reaches out in a competitive way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're trying to compete and we want to like figure each other out and scope each other out before we didn't do that. And you came at us with a realistic approach. You're just like, I want to learn from you, and let's maybe work on some jobs together. And I'm a new company. And I don't want to be the guy who knows everything. I want to be able to learn from people who've been around. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the takeaway that I've been able to kind of translate into business, is that, you know, reaching across the table and just giving a hug or thank you can go a long way than just walking in and saying, by the way, I, you know, here are my credentials, and they just slap them on the table. You know?
It's kind of like that shift between, you know, or it's a belief that there's going to be enough contracts for multiple businesses.
Right. Right?
It's like there's going to be enough to go around. And
right.
I think that, that does kind of create a better environment for, you know, I don't know, I feel like, you know, unless you have the ambition to completely dominate the market and crush
right.
every other competitor, like there's no, I mean, for most businesses, that's not even a realistic possibility.
Yeah.
And so
no.
having the attitude that, yes, we can collaborate, we can work together, you know, and then maybe you do have competitive bids and,
yeah.
and somebody loses one time, but
right.
then maybe the next time it goes the other way. Like I've definitely
Absolutely.
Had that in business too, where I've competed on bids
yeah.
with businesses owned by friends of mine, and
right.
you know, it's like,
I know.
You know, that's okay. You know, it's part of the deal.
It is. It's kind of the ebb and flow. I mean, you still have to pay your bills. You still have to feed your family. No one goes in business to live, you know, in a very substandard way. You want to grow.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, but at the same time, you also, you know, you don't want to build up a wall.
Totally.
That becomes sort of unapproachable. So
I wanted to jump into a couple of questions
sure.
on, I know you're part of starting the new TEDx program
yep.
here, and you're going to be giving a talk on cyber happiness.
Yeah. So, so I'm actually kind of, my buddy Issa Abdullah, he's a great guy. He's kind of really spearheading a lot of this
mm.
and he's asked me to kind of do some executive producing for that. And I did the website and also, yeah, he's asked me to speak and, kind of summary of that is that cyber happiness is kind of this balance between technology and kind of how our behavior relates to that technology. So it's really about taking that phone and maybe not taking a picture of that steak when you're with your friends or at a restaurant or maybe at a dinner table. You can just put your phones away and just talk with each other. And so it's not preachy relative to the TEDx, but it's really given this balance of how do we manage our expectations with the innovative side of things that we love and then this kind of impactful conversations that we often miss out
mm.
on having with our friends because we're so focused on our Instagrams or
sure.
our text messages or emails.
Mm-hmm.
So
so it's kind of like helping people find a balance or using technology instead of feeling kind of compulsively
right.
like compelled to do it.
Right. And that's exactly what it is. You just, because I embrace it, clearly. I don't know if I'm a security company, but I also recognize that I need to, like, also stop and let this marinate elsewhere and, like, really just stop and focus on the people in front of me and
right,
and like, not worry about what's, you know, what's going to vibrate in my phone, you know,
yeah.
this kind of phantom vibration.
Totally.
You know?
Like, making memories is actually
right.
more important than taking photos sometimes.
Right,
yeah.
exactly.
Or whatever, yeah,
and
totally.
It's a hard thing to sell because we are in that spectrum of everything is shareable,
mm-hmm.
everything touches, and we want to be able to show that we were skiing in Vail. We want to be able to show that we were flying to Paris, you know, and have everyone kind of focus on your life
mm-hmm.
from a voyeuristic standpoint, but I don't know.
What do you think that's about, that need to exhibit your life?
Oh my gosh, well that's when you get to the kind of cyber psychology of things. You know, I hate to say it because, you know, I saw one of those old men that's like, back in my day, you know, we used to go outside and play with rocks. But it's true though, we used to go outside and play with rocks.
Right.
We used to go outside and lay in the grass and look at clouds. I haven't done that since I was, I don't know, six. I just don't know when that left me and like, why did it leave me? What triggered it? Was it something that was in a board game? Who knows? But at some point in time, we lost our ability to kind of just be bored
mm-hmm.
and be afraid. Well, be in a zone of just being like just there and just existing and like laying on the grass. And I think we put ourselves in type of, we have to always be engaged with something. And I think that's kind of where that comes from, is that if I'm not engaged in my own life, I'm gonna have you engaged with my life.
Mm.
You know, so I'm gonna post these things and have you comment. I have a friend of mine on Facebook who only posts controversial subjects. He's the least controversial person in real life, but on Facebook, he is absolutely the most controversial person. He'll post the most ridiculous articles, and he'll say, you know, this is what I feel. He doesn't feel that way. He just wants to have a conversation. He wants to have 30 comments about some random subject about whatever. And that's just who he does. He kind of invites that crowd into his social life. But now he's kind of stuck in that social kind of parameter. And I don't know if he knows how to get out of it. Because he's lost that edge. And I know in real life, I think he's lost that kind of that authentic walk because it seems so made up.
Do you think that people are lonely and they're using like social media to just kind of...
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I just know that my personal experience has shown me that when I was like 1995, got my first little computer and I had my AOL little chat rooms and I was chatting with people at random. I was like, this is crazy. This person's in like Idaho and I'm in DC or this person's chatting. And it just felt so connected to this idea of connecting. And I don't know, I think you kind of get the bug of like reaching out to somebody who's different, especially when you reach across countries and you're playing chess, online chess, but in Holland. Yeah. Or you're, you know, so I think that becomes the tone that we tap into.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it can be both positive and negative. Like, depends on how you're using it. And I think that's what you're saying too, which is cool. It's like, it's really helping people find this, like, it's almost like having good personal hygiene when it comes to, like, you know,
that's a good way to put
like
it.
How you're using technology or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And and we know what that feels like. I mean, you could put on cologne. Or you could put on some cologne. And everyone smells you in the entire room. You walk in. I know people. I pass people on the street, and their cologne is so. So it's just one, you know, really kind of silly example. But at the end of the day, it's about moderation. It's about balance, and that's what the talk is about, essentially, for my 12 minutes.
That's really cool, and that's this June, right?
So we may move it further out because there's some scheduling.
But this summertime.
Yeah, we're trying to keep it in summertime. So, cool. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about, like, you know, you just like, I guess, are there things that you do in life that help keep you motivated, help keep you on track, just like in terms of like daily practices or like, you know, tools for getting things done or for staying?
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. You know, you kind of build a culture of fitness in the Navy. I think that's what you kind of grow into. So working out and staying healthy is huge for me, it's not like I'm looking to become the biggest guy and the most cut, but having a healthy workout routine has helped getting outside. You know, I know a lot of us are afraid to kind of go hiking again because they have this fear of like scorpions and bugs and creatures and just, you know,
dirt.
Yeah. But getting outside and walking helps just kind of facilitate for me just the freedom that I don't have inside. I hate to say it, but traveling really opens your mind because it's so cliche to say that, but it's such a good spectrum to see how other people are living and what they interpret as life, as happiness, and what they interpret as you know, and it teaches you about it. But maybe I have too much stuff,
right?
Because this person I met in Pakistan had like 10 things and he was the happiest person I've ever met.
Right.
Where I have like 100 things and I'm miserable.
Yeah.
So it's just really about leveraging your ability to kind of, you know, understand how the world works by seeing it through other people's eyes. I think having people in your life that just support you, not unconditionally, because obviously if I were to kill somebody, you probably wouldn't love me the same way after.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm like, I love you, but you got to go to jail, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think people who support you in your authentic kind of self, they just know. They can appreciate your neuroses and your abilities to kind of be off center, and they can appreciate that when you're on and when you're off. So I've surrounded myself with people in my life that I really care about, and they care about me in the same way, and it lets me be who I am, and I don't have to be in this kind of like fakery, like just kind of fake it till you make it with them. So I think that's probably the key.
So, like, really being authentically yourself.
Yeah, and that's like the holistic way to say, just live your life and be, you know, but it's just really about finding people and things in your life that just don't give you, I guess like I said, in a way that they hold you accountable to who you are. You know, like, if you were to just all of a sudden start doing crack, I probably would say, David, you probably shouldn't be doing crack. And actually, I'm not going to let you do crack, to be honest.
Right.
Because you got 2 kids. And that's just sort of one of those things. Is like, I want to see you healthy because I know you have a life outside of, you know.
Sure.
And it's the same thing with friendships. I think people who see you holistically, mm-hmm. not just what you bring to the table, but they see you holistically and they hold you accountable to that. And I think that's the rhythm that I have to follow with my friendships.
Totally. It's interesting you bring that example up of crack too, because it's like, I think that for a lot of people who do start to have like drug problems,
yeah.
it is to do with this lack of connection. It's lack of community. It's lack
right.
of like real relationships.
Right.
And so they're searching for some way to solve these
right.
problems or lack of a way to be productive in society or something like that. You
Absolutely.
Know? And I think, yeah, so it's interesting how that actually ties back to what we were talking about earlier of like the importance of actually networking and connecting
yeah.
to people. It's like connecting to other people is such a big deal, not just for business, but for like, you know, your own personal well-being. It
right.
seems, yeah.
It's all about, you know, but it's also just recognizing your own net worth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know how to do that. And I felt that all the time. I just don't, you don't know how valuable you are. One, in your own kind of perception, also in other people's interpretation of you, like what you bring to the table in someone else's life. Like you may walk into a room and just sit down and look at somebody and smile.
Mm-hmm.
And that made that person's whole year. Because you acknowledged them. And you actually saw them, you smiled at them, and then it made them feel connected in that moment with you.
Right.
And it could be a waiting room in a doctor's office. It doesn't matter. But the idea is that you don't let that just go away and just kind of put that in the third drawer of your life.
Right.
You actually elevate that talent and that gift that you've been given. Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've smiled my way out of a situation.
That's great. Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
trying to take hits, anything, like all the things.
I mean, I love that. Like the idea that any, even kind of, it's like you're highlighting the fact that small actions that maybe don't seem that consequential,
right?
They do matter, and it's more than just kind of like the big picture of, oh, I've got this degree and I'm the head of this thing
yeah.
and I'm doing that. It's
Absolutely.
Like it's like the kind of person that you are.
Yeah, it's about building a community, and it's really about building a community at the very, you know, there's a you know, I quote this all the time, and I actually forget who said it first, but I try to put love, I try to put friendships, I try to put my life and people in it to where the goats can get it, and that just means I like to put it where people can reach it, and it's not just some high arching thing you have to reach up and grab it, some tree. It's really down here in the weeds and down here in the things that kind of grow at the walking mm-hmm. level. And I think that's kind of the real solution for my life, is I've found people in my life where the goats are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where that structure lays the best foundation for me. And I can use it as a pathway to better, greater things.
That's really cool. I've never heard that analogy.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think, it's Joe Madison. He's a talk show, radio talk show.
Oh, cool.
He says it all the time. And I love that.
So how do you deal with, you know, when you're trying to build connections with people and trying to kind of create this sort of sense of community in
right.
the world, how do you deal with people who have, you know, real, you know, ideas or attitudes that are really clashing with yours?
Right.
Or like, how do you deal with that kind of conflict, I guess?
You know, it's tough because, you know, there are all these unknowns when it comes to conflict. A person may disagree with me, but my version of why they disagree with me may be different than how they actually are disagreeing with me. So I think it's about knowing aspirations. Like, if I know that you disagree with me on a subject, say gay marriage or whatever, maybe your aspirations are not well-intended. Well, maybe I don't know those aspirations well enough, and maybe my aspirations are not well-intended and they're not visible. So I think the more you can tap into someone's aspirations,
mm-hmm.
maybe tap into how they grew up, maybe tap into their psychology,
mm-hmm.
Maybe knowing more than just say, I don't agree with you.
Because mm-hmm.
there's always an onion behind that statement.
Right.
You know,
totally.
I think peeling it a little bit on different levels, not just taking the whole thing and squashing it with a hammer. You know,
right.
maybe a slow peel, maybe a hard peel, but at the end of the day, I think that's how I have learned to deal with conflict like that. It's just understanding, like, well, maybe there's a different angle why this person feels that way. Maybe
mm-hmm.
I can tap into that aspirational kind of level, and that may be the best solution.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is kind of a good segue into
yeah.
your work as the president of the Human Rights Alliance.
Right.
And
right.
So the Human Rights Alliance puts on the Gay Pride Parade, yeah. And is what else can you talk about?
Of course. So we're actually going through a branding right now, a rebranding of that. So a Human Rights Alliance, HRA, has been around since the early 90s, and it's always been kind of a, this pride parade event kind of coordination efforts to the city. It's been pretty successful, but it's also had its hiccups. It has some huge, you know, kind of PR kind of issues relative to building bridges. We're a nonprofit, and every dollar has to be accountable for. So I've taken over as president as a few months ago, and so this is really new. But it's we're trying to rebrand HRA to more of an educational space, into more of a community development space, and to into a more of a like beyond the parade space. Nothing wrong with having a parade, clearly. And we have a new board, and it's great. We have good energy. But we also want to keep this momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
We want to partner with businesses that maybe do yoga and maybe have a yoga space for trans teens, or maybe partner with the Playhouse and focus on theater that's LGBT kind of focused. And maybe there are a couple of young playwrights out there that are just kind of going through life and want to, and, you know, maybe they want to create a gay play that's sort of hard hitting.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have an outlet through the Playhouse because HRA has a partnership with the Playhouse. So leveraging our years and as a nonprofit, my vision and the vision of the board currently is to kind of extend beyond the June parade,
mm-hmm.
and get into the homes and get into the Linsics and get into bigger organizations that can really filter like our concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're still dealing with legislative LGBT issues that are not being kind of, yeah, that are being passed as of right now, especially in New Mexico. But a lot of people don't know about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of where we can fit that market and become an educational source. And who knows, man, we can have an HRA State of the Union address one day.
Right.
You know, dealing with all the issues that LGBT folks are dealing with in New Mexico and beyond. And maybe that can be something we can put out every year as a kind of a state of the kind of our community. So yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah,
and so that's like one piece of, you've got some other kind of volunteer positions as well, like, so you're keeping yourself pretty busy with like,
it's so funny, everyone always says that, right? it's a true statement to ask, like, if you write all this stuff down, like, how do you manage,
mm-hmm.
your day? But it really is the same as I did in the Navy,
right?
Because at one moment I'm an IT chief, the next moment I'm running a fire team,
mm-hmm.
you know, dealing with, you know, firefighting. The next moment, I'm running a program with mentorship. So you kind of compartmentalize your brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to do it very well. But the best solution is having a team.
Right.
So it's not just me. I mean, I may be the face of it in this respect. I'm like, oh, yeah. But every day, I look at my team and I say, thank you. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for doing that.
Right.
And it works out very well in that regard. So it's not just me.
That's cool. I wanted to circle back to, we briefly kind of touched on fitness. Do you keep yourself, like, do you orient towards any goals in that realm too? Like, do you do races or any kind of?
I used to. I've ran a few marathons and a lot of half marathons in my life, and I've done a lot of Ragnars with some friends. Those are always fun relay races.
Mm-hmm.
I think not right now. I just want to be the 80-year-old guy who still goes to gym. People think I'm 40. I want to be the guy who's like, how old are you again, sir? Oh, just 79, 80. You know, I want to be that guy who still kind of can go to the gym and still really fool some young folks thinking I'm a lot younger.
Right, cool.
So it's kind of, it's more, maybe that's a little vanity, but whatever.
Cool. And then... Yeah, so that's cool. So keeping yourself busy and dealing with that through compartmentalization, trusting your team. I guess, do you, you know, on the subject of kind of the LGBT community,
right?
Like, what's going on? What's important there in your mind?
Well, I can tell you just from my experience, and I've only kind of been in this HRA space for a few months, but obviously I've been a gay man for all my life. But I don't know, the biggest thing is really there's division at some levels,
mm-hmm.
Where groups become invisible as a byproduct of that division. I think our trans teens community, I think as I alluded to earlier, has been kind of this invisible division of our LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
as much as we want to support and give credence to like the bigger issues, I think these younger folks, especially really across the spectrum, are having a hard time identifying with where they fit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's almost like this skipping of the generation.
I see.
Where you kind of focus on this, like, millennials, and perhaps focus on the baby boomers, and that kind of, but this younger spectrum is really being ignored.
They have like different needs, and they're kind of asserting themselves in a different way. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And they're also going to just change or figure out their sexuality and their gender, and that's an even much more of a harsher space to be in, because you're in high school and you're trying to figure out your gender. Like, there's so there's this level of like, who did they reach out to?
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, I think that's kind of what we want to do as HR, is kind of bridge that gap a little bit and have a community space that people can kind of come to and just kind of feel connected to a group that's not just, I think there's so many opportunities to grow within as a young person.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're faced with fear every day and you're faced with this kind of level of uncertainty, growth is difficult, becomes a very difficult chore. So mm-hmm. now growth in that young person's mind is dangerous.
They don't feel safe to express who they are, or even just like the experimentation of trying to figure out who they are.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of, I grew up where you couldn't come out. I grew up in a neighborhood where you couldn't come out. There was none of that openness. So mm-hmm. I know what that feels like. And it's not fun.
Was your family accepting of homosexuality?
Yeah, my mom was, but I think I was around mid-20s. I probably told her.
Mm-hmm.
But she's always been my kind of big advocate anyway, biggest advocate relative to anything I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was pretty okay with it too. So I've never had, that kind of experience of my parents not accepting me.
Mm-hmm.
I had friends that kind of a little more uncomfortable with the idea, but I was very fortunate, being from the South, to have parents who really kind of just say, okay, we still love you,
Right.
Go be you, just be safe. I think they're more concerned about me being reckless relative to sexuality,
sure,
as opposed to just being one way or the other.
Practicing safe sex.
Right.
Safer sex.
Safer sex, exactly.
What was one of the toughest challenges you had to overcome growing up?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I think it was just being, I don't know what, whenever I go to a store, it was a young boy, I always knew that the manager or the supervisor or whomever already thought I was going to steal like 10 things
mm-hmm.
and try to walk out or try to, So I guess getting past that as a teenager and growing into a man, it was always in the back of my mind. Even to this day, it's still in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly successful in life, but at the end of the day, I still think about that. Like, if I go to the Target, if I go to some place, that is the kind of this image of me, this little kid who has to go talk to the right person, make sure that they know that, one, he's articulate and he can speak well and he's not just some thug or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was really hard for me growing up, trying to figure out that. And then on top of that, within my own race of friends and family, I was either one, too white, or not black enough.
I see.
So you kind of deal with that as this young guy, and you don't know who to turn to. You don't have a mentor that's kind of in that same spectrum. So it was very difficult. And then, of course, in high school, I was pretty much, a melting pot of other people like me, which actually kind of saved me a little bit. But yeah, that was one of the most difficult challenges, mm-hmm. finding your identity through these layers of your own race, mm-hmm. and then outside your race, and then kind of never really finding that middle ground until later in life. So
that makes a lot of sense. Do you think that, I guess, how do you see that issue for young people today? Is it worse? Is it better?
I think I didn't have YouTube back then. I didn't have the internet back then to kind of just browse and listen to people or browse other comments or like seek out advice. So I think kids today that maybe that version of me today, they're much more exposed to like getting help and getting understanding and getting a relationship built through the internet, through connections. And like my friend who posts on Facebook all the time about those controversial things. He gets a followership because of that.
Mm-hmm.
No. And actually, he resolves conflict through that, too. Mm-hmm. So it's not just him posting, like, you know, rape is good. He just puts stuff on there to kind of get people talking.
Right.
But sometimes he actually closes the chapter with a very insightful close. And it builds a relationship with people who really kind of fall to that mm-hmm. spectrum. So I think, if I were this young kid today, I would be much more adjusted, I think, relative to just reaching out.
Right. Yeah, there's more connection, more dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah, because, back in those days, you just had just your friends group, and you kind of, that was it.
Right.
And if they didn't like you, then you probably had to go find new friends. If they didn't like you, so you just continually to search, and I was the only child, so for me, it was like this searching around for, like, validation of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I could hang out with this guy, because I wasn't as white enough, but I could hang out with this guy, because I was black enough to hang out with him. So it's like this weird world where you have to navigate your own kind of personality.
Yeah, right. Who or what are some of your biggest influences or teachers in your life?
Oh my gosh. So the reason Merrick is called Merrick Security Solutions, MEREK, is because I had an 8th grade teacher who, Mrs. Merck, who literally sat me down one day, and I was like this snotty nosed little kid, you know, thought I knew everything. And she was like, no, you're not going to pass algebra. You're not going to pass algebra. You're not going to get 9th grade. So you need to, like, buckle down and get your stuff together. And it was like this wake-up call for me. It was like my first, I think if I had to rethink about my first defining moment as a kid growing up into, like, this next chapter, that was it.
Hmm.
So I started this company. I had to kind of come up with a name, as you can imagine. There's like...
Yeah.
That's a whole separate level of work.
Yeah.
Figuring out what makes sense to you. So clearly, Merck, which is her name, was very popular, as you know. I just switched letters around a little bit. Merrick. And it's actually a word, I think it's a German term for like ruler. But regardless, that was kind of the kind of intro into ownership is that I have to do the work. I can't just be the guy who walks in a room and smiles and kisses babies and shakes hands and gets a contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to do the work beyond the work. And that was like, that was kind of my defining moment, was thinking back, when did I first kind of come to terms with my own ability to like really navigate space? So
clearly that's really
passed,
cool.
Yeah, I passed 8th grade when 9th grade was fine. But that was the story, yeah.
That's great. Have you been in communication with that teacher since?
You know, I keep saying that story, and I've told it a number of times. I need to call her, or at least text, at least email her. She still teaches.
That's cool.
As of to this day, so.
Yeah, it probably would feel good to know that you made an impact on
somebody. I know, yeah, I think that, cool. But you know, it's interesting, because I actually have a bunch of teachers on my Facebook who I still talk to, and yeah, they have that same impact all the time. Mm-hmm. I think they get refreshed, because essentially what happens is someone posts on Mrs. Smith's page or whatever, we all chime in together. As Mrs. Smith's former student, so I think I need to definitely let Mrs. Berg know.
So, how do you measure the quality of your life?
Oh, well, I think it's interesting because quality is such a subjective term. You know, mm-hmm. you don't know what does that mean, quality. I think I measure the amount of people I get a chance to impact, and vice versa. I think if I'm impacting someone's life, and it brings them to another level where they can choose a different form of happiness. And I, in turn, get a chance to choose a different form of happiness for me. It affects all of us in the same room, or all mm-hmm. of us in the same spectrum, or they pass that forward to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I measure my quality of life in the most successful way. Like, if I could look at that and say, I met you when you were down and out. You met me when I was down and out.
Mm-hmm.
And we built each other up because we let each other in. And that was a safety, you know, feeling safe for someone. If I could feel safe in someone's life, I could feel safe in someone's choice, even in business, I think that's kind of where I can measure the most success, you know, in my life. You know, because I don't want to think about cars and houses and things when I'm on my deathbed.
Totally, that's not going to matter as much.
Or trips or whatever, or 401 kids. I want to think about who's going to hold my hand that's held my hand before.
Relationships.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of what the truest measure for me would be. If you ask me 40 years from now, I'll probably have the same answer, because I've been closer to death than I am now. So mm-hmm. relative to life. So I hope that I would have people in my life that still love me the way they love me now and would support me as I transition on.
Totally.
Yeah.
So what are you most proud of?
Oh my gosh. Wow. I think that's an equally hard question to answer because I've had an extensive career of impacting people as sailors in this case and making the right decision with their life. You know, I've had some serious knockdown drag outs with sailors who just didn't have a clue about their own identity and their own worth. And because I'm looking from the outside in and as their, you know, manager, I guess that regard. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what it is. I think I feel most proud that I have people still to this day who look at me and say, thank you for doing that because no one else did it at the time. And it shaped my life in a way that's kind of, you know, just kind of made it more positive. So, and I think I'm probably even more proud to have had that happen to me when I was younger and that I was had the foresight to continue doing it. You know, not just having it done to me, someone take me to the side, pull me by my ear and say, hey, here's what you need to do. But I've actually done the same thing by paying that forward in my life. You know,
that's great. So it's like the mentorship cycle.
It truly is. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So
that's great. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And then let's see. Okay. Yeah. Just a couple more questions, really. And I think we can wrap. I guess what really matters to you or what matters most to you right now?
What matters most to me right now? Well, clearly I want to have a successful business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to have I really want HRA to really blossom, to the, you know, and go beyond this kind of parade aspect. But I also want my relationship, you know, with my friends and family to grow. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that really, I want us to all grow together. I hate to say it so cliche, but I want this business to retire. I want this business to see, because I want to retire my friends and family. I want my friends to succeed so we can all grow together, raising their kids in a very successful way. You know, I want all these things to kind of really touch each other. So I don't want independent kind of successes.
Mm-hmm.
I want a global success with everything that impacts me. That it's ambitious, clearly. But I want my life to kind of impact other people mm-hmm. and their life to impact other people and that kind of domino effect to happen. I don't want to be successful in a vacuum.
Right.
I don't want to have a relationship with my fiance and that just be out of the vacuum.
Right.
I want our house to be, you know, be open to people who are friends and not just have a house just for us. I want to have a car that drives us to not Albuquerque, but drives my friends to Denver. You know, so I mm-hmm. think that's kind of where this is all going. I don't want to have success or happiness in a vacuum. I want it to be shared.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very odd coming from an only child to say that, but I want it to be shared. I want everything to be layered
right.
and given, you know, given to away. And I don't want to have success in this kind of space where it can't be nurtured for other people to use.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
yeah, I really like that.
Thanks.
And I guess two more questions.
Sure.
One, do you have any advice for kind of, you know, people just starting, you know, just wanting to start a new business
right.
or kind of like young entrepreneurs? Like,
yeah, I mean, it goes without saying, networking, networking, networking. It is the key, and it's an essential key to getting past all the red tape. I would have literally been kind of at the beginning stages of this business with really no real kind of momentum had I not networked and just been at the forefront of like senators, not senators, but like city councilors and like focusing on conventions and conferences. They've really helped. And, you know, not being afraid to like just fail
mm-hmm.
and not being afraid to say that was dumb or you try it again, you know, like, I think that's kind of what we have to do, is that I fail on a daily basis, mm-hmm. you know, that's why I wake up 2 o'clock in the morning with these ridiculous things I got to do, because I didn't do it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because, so, it's just one of those things where you have to just be afraid, you can't be afraid to just, like, start from scratch again, mm-hmm. and let it marinate a different way. Maybe the temperature's too high, maybe going in too hot, maybe lower that thermostat down a little bit. Or maybe you're coming in too cold and you're not approachable. You know, so I think becoming being approachable, networking yourself to death, not being afraid to just say, well, that wasn't how I intended it, but we're gonna go with it. You know, because at the end of the day, you never know where that leads itself to. Mm-hmm. I had a friend of mine years and years ago. He always said the same thing: never turn down a blind date. If she's ugly, if she's whatever, you go on that date with her and you have the best date. Because you never know who her cousin is, you never knew who her sister is, you never knew who her auntie is, and they may be the hardest thing you've ever seen. And it's a really navy way to say things, sailor right. logic. But it's the mindset of, like, you never turn away an opportunity, because, you know, opportunity comes in different forms. You know, you may look for this magical, like, golden ticket of a job opportunity within this kind of spectrum. But you may get, like, a small blue ticket from what that you get from the Dollar Tree. Hmm. But that opens up another door that you never thought you were going to go through. So keep an open mind, be networking, and focusing on the fact that you're going to fail. And it's okay to fail, but you get right back up and get back on the horse. And that's really saved me. If that's I went into with any other mindset, I would have a business. I would have a business, and I wouldn't be happy.
Right. Wow, that's really, really insightful.
Thank you.
So the kind of final question I have for you is something I've been asking everybody. Yeah. Basically, like, if you had the ability to kind of just implant one idea or practice in all people across the globe, so you get to wave your magic wand and say, like, you know, now everybody on earth is going to do this thing or have this idea, what would that be for you?
Ooh, that's like, oh my God, such a hard question to answer. It's like raising the temperature of the earth 1 degree. Maybe in some parts it's nice, other parts it's not so nice.
Right.
I think I would systematically, and it would have to be something that was, you know, like, maybe articulated better than how I'm going to say it. But I think I would want everyone to change their consciousness in a way that allows them to know that we're all connected in some kind of way. May not be in the foo-foo, like, hanging out in kumbaya world, but it's definitely this connectedness that we all share, mm-hmm. that we often ignore. Because, you know, I don't want to relate to you. I want you to, like, you know, not like me or vice versa. But I think I would implant in the very instance of everyone waking up in the morning is that we're all kind of in this connectedness, and doesn't mean like each other, mm-hmm. doesn't mean to be best friends, but we're still connected. And when it comes down to it, we can help each other grow in a way that's based off our consciousness, based off our ability to kind of think at a higher level, you know, beyond the flair, beyond the glamour muscles, beyond the clothes, beyond all the things that don't matter, but get into the nitty gritty of kind of where the ghosts are. So that's kind of what I would do.
I love that. Thank you. Yeah, that's great. That's a good...
Well, it's a hard question to answer, like, off the cuff, you know.
Totally. No, it's a fun one to spring on people, because, you know, some people have their answer just wired to, like, well, I would definitely teach people this. You know, it's funny.
That was not wired.
I think it's a really insightful remark, though. So
awesome. Thank you.
Really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Oh, my gosh, that's great. Yeah,
Yeah, definitely look forward to connecting with you in the future.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Cool.
Awesome.
That's all for this week's installment of The Created Life. Please tune in next week for an interview with the talented Jackie Monroe, a documentary filmmaker who's passionate about telling stories that empower and connect communities. Until next time, this is Damian Taggart wishing you a happy and healthy week.